We're very fortunate to have as our special guest Irish journalist and author Fintan O'Toole. Mr. O'Toole is a drama critic and columnist for the newspaper The Irish Times. From 1997 to 2001, he was also drama critic for the New York Daily News. In 1993, Mr. O'Toole was elected Irish Journalist of the Year for his work in exposing political corruption. His many books include A Traitor's Kiss, a highly acclaimed biography of Irish playwright Richard Brinsley Sheridan. His particular interest in the Irish in America is reflected in his recent biography of Irish-born columnist William Johnson, entitled White Savage, William Johnson and the Invention of America. Thanks very much for being with us, Mr. O'Toole.
It's a real pleasure.
What distinctive qualities did the Irish bring to America that helped shape who we are as Americans?
I think what the Irish brought to America more than any other quality was a certain flexibility. You know, if you look back over the last couple of hundred years, many of the different peoples who shaped the modern United States obviously had their own very distinctive cultures. They had, you know, fantastic contributions to make. What perhaps is most notable about the Irish is that they were in a position historically and culturally where they had to be quite inventive about trying to create a place for themselves and trying to create an identity for themselves. And so they brought to America a certain kind of inventive energy, I suppose, which expressed itself in all sorts of different ways, but which made them a particular kind of force in the American context, whereby they weren't just another of the ethnic groups. I think they were also one which saw itself as being able to deal with all of the other groups, to adopt different identities, to converse with people, to organize in ways which were really rooted in the particular circumstances that people left behind in Ireland, and which gave them that kind of energy.
The role of the Irish immigrant in American history is a very long one. Americans have a stereotype that all the Irish were the poor country folk who came to this country in the aftermath of the mid-19th century Irish potato famine, and they were all Catholic and they all settled in big northeastern cities. Is that an accurate image?
Well, it isn't, in fact. You know, you're absolutely right about the stereotype, and it's one which is actually, oddly enough, held by a lot of Irish people as well. But if you look at the reality is a majority of Irish Americans are actually Protestant. And it did not start, the Irish exodus to America certainly did not start at the time of the potato famine in the mid-19th century. I mean, it really goes back to the very beginnings of English settlement in continental USA, going almost right back to the early years of the 17th century. And certainly the biggest proportional influence, you could say, of the Irish was actually in the 18th century, when they were a very, very important factor in the early settlement of a lot of the eastern seaboard and moving out beyond the original cities that the English had set up in Boston and New York. So, you know, the Irish were moving in quite substantial numbers. They're a very important aspect in what we would now call the Appalachian settlements. You know, your typical American person who is you know, I suppose, kind of seen as the backbone of a certain kind of old rural America. An awful lot of those people would have been people who would have come from the north of Ireland, who would have been Protestants, Presbyterians, very many of them. Very often they would have had, in their own backgrounds, you know, going back a couple of hundred years, they would have had a Scottish origin. They're often referred to as the Scots-Irish, but they regarded themselves, and they were thought of at the time, as Irish people, and they were really the backbone of a lot of the pioneering settlements in the 18th century. So really what's interesting in many ways about the Irish relationship with America is that it's a continuous one, and it's really been around pretty much as long as America has been around.
When you speak of the 18th century and frontier settlement, that brings us to William Johnson, because that was his period. I was astonished to learn in your biography of William Johnson that he was the prototype for the first literary, the first Superman in the American literature. People like Hawkeye and James Fenimore Cooper novels, and the novels of James Paulding's. How did William Johnson evolve into this superhero status?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question, I think, because it is one of the prototypes in many ways of a kind of American Irish identity. Is this notion of the white savage, which is the title I use in the book, but the notion of the white man who is almost like an Indian, and who's out in the frontier and is out in the woods and is adopting a lot of those kind of Indian traits. This guy William Johnson really is in many ways the prototype for it, because he was an Irishman from a kind of distressed Catholic gentlefolk background in Ireland, who were being quite severely repressed at the time, left to try to remake his own fortune and to remake his family fortune in the 1730s, ended up in what's now upstate New York. But at the time was a really critical kind of area, because it was the frontier between French America in Canada and English America, and that was a really contested and very bloody frontier.
This is an area just west of Albany on the Mohawk River.
That's right. It's that whole Mohawk Valley region, and then his influence would have stretched right up into what's now the Canadian border. That was a territory which was very contested. Both sides claimed it. It was fought over in the late 1740s, all through the 1750s, and really right up until the British actually managed to defeat the French and take over in Canada. Johnson kind of controlled that territory very largely, and he did so interestingly by exercising this kind of flexibility that I was talking about in relation to the way the Irish operate, because he was someone who, unlike almost every other senior so-called British colonist, was able to create a relationship with the Indians, particularly with the Iroquois Indians who control that territory. He was inducted into the Mohawk tribe. He became a kind of leading Indian, as well as being an Irishman and as well as being a kind of British colonial official. And he created this kind of little empire for himself, which was very influential in terms of the long-term creation of America, because it was one of the key factors in the reasons that the British were able to defeat the French. What was that Johnson was able to create these Indian alliances for them. And in many ways, Johnson is a very interesting figure in himself, but he's also very interesting, I think, in terms of this kind of Irish identity, because he was a very, very flexible figure. You know, he was able to be a different kind of person in different company. When he was with the Indians, he was an Indian. He often dressed in Indian dress. He had an Indian wife. He had Indian children. When he was with the British, he was a typical colonial gentleman, you know, who had a fine house and paintings and books and music and all of those kinds of things. He was ostensibly Protestant, but there was a very strong element of Catholicism in his own background.
He was raised a Catholic, and then he became
He was raised as a Catholic, indeed, and he was one of those kind of families who shifted officially to Protestantism in order to try to preserve their status. But
also in the context of upstate New York politics, the French were Catholics; they were the enemy, so it would be hard to be trusted and be Catholic.
Oh, absolutely. It was, it was more or less understood to be the same thing as treason, you know, to be a Catholic, and Catholics were extremely mistrusted. So Johnson was one of these people who I don't think he cared terribly much about what he was, but he certainly adopted an outward and official Protestantism, but he retained very strongly this sense of a kind of old romantic Irish identity, which was Catholic and to which he was still very, very strongly attached. And I think what's interesting is that he was kind of creating this flexibility, this mobility of identity, which I suppose is what we think of as typically American in a lot of ways. And I think that's what made him such a powerful figure, not just in historical terms, but also in mythical terms, you know, that he became someone who was written about by novelists just as much as by historians.
He seems to have had an unusual ability to relate to the Indians. You describe a meeting he had in 1746 where he made this dramatic entrance with the Indians. Can you relate that to us when he goes to meet Governor Clinton?
Yeah, but it was a very important moment because it was at a time when the colonial English were getting ready for a conflict with the French, and they had previously not been very successful in terms of actually creating Indian alliances, and you know the Indians were really important militarily. We think about the 19th century when they were. That they were massively militarily defeated, but at this time they were still very, very important militarily because they knew how to fight in this strange terrain, and Europeans didn't. You know, Europeans were used to big pitched battles. The Indians were used to fighting in woodland and in the lakes and in the mountains, and they were very important. And the British were desperately looking for Indian allies. And Johnson really presented himself at this kind of key meeting where the British were getting together in Albany. And he arrived, you know, dressed as an Indian war chief with Iroquois warriors following him. And this was a kind of sensational appearance, you know. So here's our problem is creating these Indian alliances. And here we have this person who is is himself an Indian white man, you know, who's appearing in this guise and therefore has a very, very important political impact, and really quite astonished most of the colonial officials. But of course, he was doing this partly to give himself a status. He knew what the colonial officials needed, and he knew that by being able to demonstrate his own influence with the Indians in this way, by appearing as their chief, you know, he was putting himself in a position where he could actually negotiate and carve out an important role for himself, and eventually that's the role that he got. He became the superintendent for Indian affairs for North America, where basically all the relationships between the colonial British and the Indian tribes had to go through William Johnson.
He seemed to have a great flair for the dramatic, which came to his help when he was trying to get the Indians behind the war effort against the French. And you described a meeting in 1755 where he used the imagery of a bundle of sticks, and he effectively used some of the other chiefs to help him. Could you talk about that meeting?
Yeah, one of the things I found fascinating in looking into this was, you know, that relationships with the Indians were actually very theatrical in a way, because the Iroquois in particular were very sophisticated people, and they had what we would kind of look at now as something like a parliament or a senate, you know, where they had these very large meetings, and the rhetoric at these meetings, the way you address people, the way you follow the certain kind of ceremonial codes, was very, very important in terms of impressing people, and you needed to impress them if you wanted them on your side. And Johnson was one of the few people who actually mastered these ceremonials and mastered this kind of rhetoric. He was a big man. He was an impressive man, and that very much appealed to the mentality of the Indians. But in this particular occasion, when you know he was attempting to deal with a political problem, which was a lot of the Iroquois didn't want to get involved in the fighting between the British and the French. I mean, you know, in retrospect, you'd probably say they were dead right from their point of view. And Johnson's job was to try to overcome the divisions within the Iroquois and to bring them onto the British side. And part of the way this was done was in collaboration with some of the Indian chiefs with whom he was friendly. They created this metaphor, really, of a bunch of sticks and showing how a bunch of sticks, you know, if you take them individually, you can break them. And if you put them together, you tie them together, you cannot break them. You know, for us, it's a very, very simple image, but it was a very powerful piece of political persuasion. Really,
and he stage managed it in such a way that he got other respected Indians to do this on behalf of him, right? Red Hand was one of the men that worked with him?
That's right. He was very clever in the way that he was able to make very strong personal alliances with influential chiefs. This guy Red Hand was one of them. But what the Red Hand thing was impressive about was that Red Hand wasn't seen as one of his allies. So he was able to get to a guy like Red Hand, to persuade him to be the one who would make Johnson's points for him, and realizing, of course, that this would be much more impressive if it was seen as coming from someone who had previously been skeptical of Johnson.
Do you think that was prearranged?
It seems to me to be pretty clear in looking at the documentation that this was prearranged, you know, that he was, in a sense, Johnson was kind of staging these theatrical spectacles, you know. He wasn't just talking to people on a simple rational level. He was also putting forward ways of attempting to do this,
but which
were theatrical.
He was not only successful getting the Indians behind the British effort against the French, but he also was a successful battle leader, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. He was someone who had no military experience, but who found himself being placed in a very important military position. He was appointed as General Johnson, and he was made really the leader of one of the three armed campaigns that the British were intending to wage against the French. And he was put in a position really where he had to assume a kind of military command, which historically was very important because Johnson's force was made up entirely of Americans. You know, it was made up of colonial, white colonials and Indian allies. And they were going to face a professional French army. And, you know, most Americans know that it was very important that Americans learned that they could take on professional European armies. And they did this, obviously, in 1776 and in the War of Independence. But Johnson was doing this in the mid-1750s. And he was really the first person who successfully defeated or at least fought to a standstill a professional French army, which he did at the Battle of Lake George in 1755. The battle was kind of a bit of a draw, really, if you wanted to look at who won it. You had a French force, and you had this kind of combined American colonial Indian force under Johnson. It was quite a bloody encounter. In a way, nobody really won militarily, but Johnson managed to capture the French commander, and that gave him, in propaganda terms, the victory, which was very important at a time when the British were losing all of the campaigns at the time. There was a whole string of British defeats, and Johnson was able to win. He was able to capture the French general, and this made him a huge figure because the British government needed a victory. They picked on Johnson as a great American hero, and he, very unusually for an American, he was made a baronet, so he became Sir William Johnson, and the Parliament in London voted him a very substantial amount of money, and he began to become a kind of a big international figure at that time. Because of that.
Well, it really resulted in, his efforts resulted in North America becoming British, correct?
Well, yes. I mean, he was a very important factor in that because the great advantage that the French had militarily was not numbers. I mean, the British colonies were much bigger, they had much, much better manpower, they had more money, you know, they had control of the seas, but the French were defeating them all around because the French had worked very hard on Indian alliances, and they'd used their Indian allies very, very well to be able to fight in that terrain. And the only person really on the British side who could match that and eventually turn the tide was Johnson. And it was certainly a huge factor in the defeat of the French. Johnson led the British forces at the Siege of Niagara. Fort Niagara was kind of strategically critical to be able to actually use that as a base to cut the French in Canada off from the French in the west of what's now the United States, and he won that victory, and that really allowed the British then to successfully invade Canada. So Johnson was certainly a very important figure in the reason why we're now speaking in English and not in French. He definitely had a very, very important impact on that.
Well, Johnson was not only not the only Irish American who was to become sort of a model, a folk legend in American history. There's another character who became important in the folk legends of the American West, and his name was Henry McCarty. And you've written about him, and I understand you're going to be soon coming out with a book on his life. Could you tell us about Henry McCarty?
Well, Everybody listening knows who Henry McCarthy is.
I don't think so. You'll have to tell us.
They don't think they do, but if I said Billy the Kid, then they'd have a clear idea who I am.
That would ring a bell, yes.
And this is, it's fascinating a story in itself, I think, because, you know, why do people know who Billy the Kid is? You know, or why do they think they know who Billy the Kid is? This is, it's one of those strange, mythical stories in a way, because, you know, if you look at historically, this guy was just another punk, another killer in an era when there were an awful lot of them around. He didn't achieve an awful lot, but he is this mythical figure. And even if you stop somebody in the street in China, you know, and you said Billy the Kid, they'd probably nod their head and have some idea who you're talking about.
But they don't associate him with as an Irish American.
They certainly would not associate him as an Irish American at all, I think. And yet, not only was Billy the Kid Irish, as you say, his name was Henry McCarthy, but almost all of the people that he killed and all of the violence and the historical events that he was involved with were really very heavily Irish. It was an event called the Lincoln County War, which broke out in New Mexico in the late 1870s, and that was a really strange and almost surreal event, really, where you had competition for the control of a very substantial part of New Mexico between an Irish gang, if you like to call them that, and a sort of British gang. And they fought each other to a standstill. They slaughtered pretty much everybody on either side. And it was an extremely strange event. And one of the few people who emerged out of it or seemed to escape from that violence was this young guy called Henry McCarthy, Billy the Kid, who, of course, ultimately was killed. But the fact that he had escaped for a certain period, I suppose, made him the figure that attracted attention out of these very strange events, and he became the figure that we know. But largely the people that he was involved with were Irish famine emigrants. I mean, people who had left Ireland, young men, they joined the American Army. They would have been involved in the Civil War, and then they would have been involved in the wars against the Apache Indians down there, left the army, and they were people who were inured to violence. You know, they'd probably seen a hell of a lot of violence in the course of their lives. They carved out a territory for themselves in New Mexico. They were doing very well, and then they were suddenly confronted with an English merchant coming in and essentially trying to take it away from them. And you got this very strange frontier war, which was not fought between white people and Indians, but was fought between two different factions of Western European whites.
So Billy the Kid was a hired hand for the Irish faction?
Well, this is what made him strange, I think, in that you would expect, since he was Irish, that he would have been fighting for the Irish faction. In fact, he ended up fighting for the English faction, if you like. And I think this is maybe one of the reasons why he became the figure that emerged out of these strange events, because he didn't make any sense. You know, he was on the wrong side, if you like, in those terms. But he was the guy who was actually killing a lot of the Irish. He killed the Irish sheriff, and you know, he fought against the Irish gang. It seems to me for that reason that, you know, he kind of gathered a lot of the mystery of these events around him. This was a kind of an event that didn't make any sense in terms of you know, the big story of American history. This was not supposed to be what American history was about. And because it was mysterious, you know, it attracted novels and then later on, like, you know, plays and films and ballets and operas, you name it. People have written something about this strange event. But it captures, I think, a lot of, going back to the Johnson thing, you know, this sort of flexibility, this mystery, this sense of an identity which is very fluid, and which feeds into American consciousness because it doesn't quite fit anywhere, and therefore becomes interesting because it's not predictable.
Well, you've talked about the importance, especially in Johnson novel, of the Irish roots of William Johnson, and with a political situation between the English and the Irish. For some of our listeners who aren't as familiar with that, when did the English first come to Ireland to conquer it?
Well, English settlement, I suppose, started with the Normans, who were actually French. They conquered England in the 11th century. Then they came into Ireland in the 12th century, and really for 400 or 500 years, you had a struggle for control of Ireland. But Gradually, you had more and more English and Scottish settlement coming into Ireland, and the English would have become completely dominant. Really, at a time that's almost, you can almost date it to almost exactly 400 years ago. So 400 years ago, this year was the year in which the last of the big, great old Irish chieftains, you know, Irish-speaking, Gaelic, Catholic chiefs, they left Ireland, having been defeated by the English forces.
And the occupation during the 1600s and the 1700s was very harsh and very anti-Catholic.
It was harsh. It was made harsher than, you know, there were lots of occupations in Europe and lots of people moving in on each other's territory, and in some ways that was typical. But what made it particularly harsh in Ireland was the religious aspect of it. That the England of the time was militantly Protestant. You know, it was really at the cusp of this new religion. The majority in Ireland, again, unusually, I mean, mostly in Europe, people went with whatever religion the rulers had. You know, so if your ruler was Protestant, you ended up being a Protestant. If your ruler was Catholic, you stayed Catholic. What was unusual about Ireland was that the majority of the native Irish remained Catholic, and they began to see Catholicism as kind of critical to their identity, their Irish identity, whereas the rulers and the ruling class and a lot of the wealthier classes, a lot of the landowning classes, were Protestant. And that created a divide which, to some extent, we're still living with, you know, this very unfortunate mixture of religion and politics. It's a dangerous combination in a lot of circumstances, as we know, and it created a lot of the troubles in Ireland, which hopefully are beginning to come to an end only now.
So when the Irish came to America in the 18th century, for example, they came with an anti-British bias, and I've read that as many as a third of George Washington's troops were Irish.
Yes, that's absolutely true. I mean, Ireland was a very politicized place, you know, people were coming to America with a whole kind of background in politics, revolutionary politics for many of them. You know, many of them would have experienced, or at least their fathers or grandfathers would have experienced major rebellions. You know, it was kind of in the blood there to a large extent. And one of the things that was interesting was that this was equally true of the Presbyterian Protestant Irish as it was of a lot of the Catholic Irish, because people forget that Presbyterianism at the time was almost as repressed as Catholicism was. You know, there was the official state church, which was the Episcopalian or Anglican Church, as it was called, and everything else was regarded as being not acceptable. And Presbyterians experienced a great deal of discrimination in Ireland as well, and also in the early pre-colonial America. And it was only it was only when they began to get involved in politics, particularly in revolutionary politics, that Presbyterianism began to become part of the American official mainstream. So you're absolutely right. I mean, a lot of the foot soldiers of the American War of Independence were from that Irish background, that sort of Scottish-Irish Presbyterian background, but also to some extent from the Catholic background. These were outsiders, and therefore I suppose they were people who felt that they had less of a stake in the established order of things, and they were more inclined to go with revolutionary politics than to try to defend the status quo.
Sometimes there was an almost direct connection between Irish politics and domestic American politics, as in the connection between the United Irishmen and the rising of 1798 in Ireland and the resistance to the Alien Sedition Acts of 1798 in the United States. There were actually some of the same people would be involved, weren't they not?
That's absolutely true. The 1798 rebellion was, just to explain it, was you know, probably the biggest attempted revolution in Irish history. In some ways, the most tragic, because it was the one that you know, in one way seemed most promising. It united for the first time, really, Protestants and Catholics. The United Irishmen took their name from their ideology, which was to sink all the religious differences in what they said was the common name of Irishmen. And so a lot of the leaders of the United Irishmen were actually Protestants. They were Presbyterians. They were also Anglicans, Episcopalians. And you know, there was also very, very substantial Catholic involvement in it, and they were defeated. It was a very, very bloody episode, and many of those who managed to escape went to America. America was the place that they looked to for safety, because a lot of them had been inspired originally by American and by American ideals, you know. So they had a certain kind of connection already with the United States, the young United States. And they began to arrive in America at the end of the 18th century, the beginning of the 19th century, and they were already kind of radicalized. And they were, however, you know, arriving at a time when America was putting up laws against, as you say, the Alien Sedition Acts, which were, you know, seeing foreigners arriving in as being potentially revolutionary, potentially unsettling. They were setting up these acts to try to exclude such people. And then you had this very highly motivated and in many cases highly educated core of people coming from Ireland who fell right into this category. I mean, if you like, they were alien and they were used to trying to undermine an established order. So they were almost put directly into conflict with the existing laws. And they were a very important source of the agitation to undermine those laws, to feed into a new kind of radicalism in American politics at the time.
And didn't British politics play into it, because the Alien Sedition Act was put through by President John Adams, Federalist, who was very pro-British,
opposed
by Vice President Thomas Jefferson, who was forming a new party and was more sympathetic to the ideals of the French Revolution.
That's absolutely true. I mean, the whole... You know, you must remember this was a time of really enormous war, which, you know, went on for a very, very long period between the British and the French, and that was certainly shaping American politics. You know, the new American rulers were themselves divided between pro-British and pro-French factions, and here you had these Irish people arriving in who had already been in alliance with the French. The United Irishmen were allies of the French. They sought French assistance. They tried to bring French troops into Ireland. You know, so for pro-British Americans, they were obviously going to be seen as being a potentially hostile and disruptive force. But for the Jeffersonians, you know, for the radicals who were pro-French, they were seen as a really good source of new energy, new allies, and people who had the same ideas as themselves. So they were actually really quite important in shaping the outcome of that struggle in early 19th century America.
There's a populist streak in the Irish American participation here, and to some extent that may be influenced by their experience in Ireland with the Catholic Emancipation Movement. Could you talk about that?
Well, one of the really probably unique things you could say about Ireland in the early to mid 19th century is that what you had in Ireland was maybe the first time ever anywhere in the world you had a mass political movement. You know, we've had political movements, of course, forever. You had the masses involved in many ways in armies or, you know, in revolutions. But our notion of, say, a mass political party, you know, where you had, you know, hundreds of thousands of very ordinary poor people being members of a political organization, taking part, subscribing, attending meetings, you know, voting on things. That kind of model was actually a very, very new thing, and it emerged to a large extent in Ireland in the 1820s because of the great populist Catholic leader, a guy called Daniel O'Connell, who was an extraordinary figure, you know, who managed to create, with the aim of overturning the anti-Catholic laws, he created this huge association where, instead of having very, very wealthy backers, which is what you had in those days, I mean, you know, nobody got involved in politics unless they were a lord or they were a very, very wealthy business person. O'Connell had a new idea that you could set up a big political movement by taking tiny amounts of money from very poor people. So, you know, you had, if a million people gave you a penny, you know, which would be the equivalent of a cent a week, that still created a lot of money, and it created a big fighting fund to establish your newspapers, your mass meetings, your agitation. So a huge number of Irish people would have had experience of being involved in politics. And these were, in many ways, the same people who were then hit by the tragedy of the Great Famine in the 1840s, and who ended up seeking refuge in America. So the famine Irish, the people who flooded into Boston and New York and almost every other part of the United States in the 1840s, 1850s, they were unusual in that they were people who had experience of political organization and being involved directly themselves in politics. And as a result of that, they were a very important force in the creation of modern American politics. The modern American Democratic Party very largely came out of these people because they were able to set up big political machines in those vast American cities. They had advantages because they were already English speaking, which was a very big advantage compared to a lot of the other migrants who were coming in, and they knew about how to do politics, and gradually they began to take over the Democratic Party in those cities, in Chicago, in Boston, in New York, in Philadelphia, you know, to build these machines, and then they were in a position with all the new migrants coming in many ways, incorporate those new migrants into those Irish machines, you know, and to divide up the power and to incorporate a lot more people into American politics. In many ways, you could say it was cynical. It was to their own advantage. But I think it did have a very important impact in terms of allowing a lot of other poor people to begin to get some kind of hand on the political machine at that time.
The two examples of these Irish-American populist leaders in big cities would be the grandparents of President John Kennedy. His grandfathers were Mayor John Fitzgerald and Patrick J. Kennedy, who were political leaders in Boston.
That's right, that's right. I mean, I suppose Boston was kind of the archetypal Irish-American city, if you like, and you know, the Irish essentially ran that political machine, and the Kennedys very much emerged out of that. You know, they had experience of getting involved in that from a very early stage, and they were able to build that over the generations, you know, into becoming the first Irish Americans and the first Catholics to actually go all the way up to the presidency. More typically, these were kind of city organizations, you know, which didn't really look to have a vast impact on national politics. They were very content to run the big cities, which was remarkable if you think about it, because these were mostly, I mean, the Irish were mostly rural people when they started out. You know, they came from the countryside. They didn't even come from cities. A lot of people who ended up in New York and Boston had never in their lives even been in Dublin. And yet, they were very good at getting to grips with how to operate in a city context, and they were able to take control really of the city politics. And you had guys like Al Smith, you know, who was the legendary New York machine operator. You got the dailies running in Chicago, which is still the case. I mean, you know, the mayor of Chicago is still a daily, you know, even to this day, and.
It's a long distance from the Mayor Daley's or Honey Fitz, Mayor John Fitzgerald of Boston, to President John Kennedy. How did the family make that transition from the small urban stage to the global stage?
Well, I think the Kennedys were unusual in that, first of all, they had huge ambition. You know, they were a family who, you know, went kind of classic routes. You know, they went from being a dirt poor Irish, you know, the ancestor who went over, you know, died only a couple of years after he went over because he was so overworked, you know, in really terrible manual jobs. Then the next generation got into the Irish pubs and, you know, running bars and making a bit of money. They even got into prohibition, you know, and breaking prohibition in the 1930s. You know, they were very ambitious in terms of moving up the ladder, and I think the Kennedys were unusual in that they had some sort of inbuilt sense that every generation is going to be bigger than the last generation. You know, they never seemed to get contented at any particular stage, and they had this extraordinary drive. So, you know, old Kennedy, you know, the father of John F. Kennedy, he became the American ambassador to the United Kingdom, to London, which, you know, would have been an incredibly prestigious position to take. But he wasn't contented with that. You know, he was determined that one of his sons was going to be president. And, you know, even when his eldest son was killed during the Second World War, you know, he picked on the next son. You know, there was this relentless drive. And so they had that ambition. They had education. They were very highly educated, you know, and they were able to get rid, if you like, of the whole kind of lace curtain Irish thing, you know, to move up socially into a higher stratum. They had a lot of money. They'd made money through Prohibition, through the movies. You know, they'd moved into different industries, and so that they were probably pushing it up to a higher level of ambition. And yet, you know, I think what's fascinating about the Kennedys is that, in a lot of ways, you know, that the Kennedys were, it was a very cynical kind of operation. You know, they were driven by naked ambition, and yet somehow, when they did get into power, they retained an extraordinary idealism. You know, somehow out of this this very narrow, very very grasping kind of mentality, they still retained that sense of a greater purpose. You know, and you did get, you know, people have very divided views about the Kennedys, but maybe they're divided views for good reasons, you know, that there were bad sides of the Kennedys, but there were also extraordinarily good sides and an extraordinary idealism.
When you talk about the idealism of the Kennedys, the Peace Corps, the Alliance for Progress comes to mind. These ideas are, do you think they were had their roots in his Irish background?
I think they did, you know, because I think that, you know, one of the things that happened with the Kennedys was that, in spite of their own wealth and power and the achievements that they managed, there was still some kind of memory of poverty, you know, some memory of having come from somewhere outside of what had been previously the American establishment, you know, and some sense that, you know, that you could act as a way of opening a door, and, you know, for other generations and other people to come in and follow behind you. I mean, I would hope that that's the case, you know, that people do remember something, not just about their own lives, but about the lives of their ancestors, you know, and that, you know, sometimes this sort of ancestor worship can become sentimental and romantic and you know, can be a bad thing. But I think there's an element of it where, you know, if we all remember that we didn't come from wealth and we didn't come from privilege, that, you know, our ancestors were also the people on the outside who were being kicked around at one stage, I think it can, you know, give people an edge when they do get a bit of power and influence to try to remember that and to try to do constructive things that might help other people to be able to achieve what they've achieved.
Thank you very much, Mr. O'Toole. I'm afraid we'll have to bring it to an end here, but we've enjoyed our conversation so much.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
We've been talking to Fintan O'Toole, drama critic and columnist with the Irish Times, and whose book on Billy the Kid will be coming out very soon.